The weekend events of Charlottesville continue to reverberate with President Trump's insistence yesterday that the violence was caused by, quote, both sides. Today, we talked to different people in Illinois about how they're processing this. Here's State Senator Daniel Biss.
I think we need to look inside of ourselves and know that that evil can find a home in anyone if we don't watch out for it and conduct ourselves in a certain way. And we also have to know that that good lies in everyone.
Plus, Christian Piccolini is a former skinhead who walked away and is now trying to get others to do the same.
I think I'm living proof that somebody can change. I didn't start out as a racist. I became a racist for 7 years. So I wasn't born that way. So I did change from being a non-racist to a racist back to a non-racist.
What about you? What conversations are you having that you want to share with us right now? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455 or tweet to 21STShow, and we'll have that conversation right after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're still feeling days later the ripple effects of the weekend's events in Charlottesville, Virginia, where a group of neo-Nazis and white supremacists protested the removal of a Confederate statue. When counter-protesters pushed back, a car plowed into them and killed 32-year-old Heather Heyer. Yesterday, President Trump added fuel to the fire by claiming that, quote, both sides were responsible for the weekend violence, not specifically neo-Nazis and white supremacists. Today, we're going to be talking to people in Illinois about how they're reacting to all of this. And we want to hear from you. What conversations have you been having about this that you'd love to share with us right now? Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. Again, that number is 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with a Black Lives Matter activist in Springfield, one of the co-founders of that chapter, as well as the co-founder of Life After Hate's Christian Piccolini. But first, on Sunday, State Senator Daniel Biss gave a speech on the floor of the State House. It was while senators were passing a resolution condemning the events in Charlottesville. It was also meant to encourage Illinois law enforcement agencies to recognize white supremacist groups as terrorist organizations. Yesterday afternoon, before President Trump spoke, I talked to Senator Biss. He's a Democrat who represents Illinois' 9th district, which includes the northern Chicago suburbs from Glencoe to Evanston, where he lives. Senator Biss, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, thanks for having me, Nyla.
This isn't a topic you talk very much about, but you shared the story of your maternal grandmother on the Senate floor on Sunday as there was discussion around a resolution for condemning what happened over the weekend in Charlottesville. Do you mind, can you share the story of what you told your colleagues with our audience now?
Yeah, my mother's parents were born in a small town on the border of Hungary and Romania. And in 1944, my grandmother and her family were put on a rail car, and that took them to Auschwitz. They got off the rail car, and they were separated by generation. My grandmother's generation were sent off to have a serial number tattooed on their arm as though they were cattle or an object. And her parents were sent the other direction, directly to the gas chambers, and they never saw each other again. Now, my grandmother was fortunate enough and scrappy enough to survive and move back to the town where she grew up, got married. My mother was born in September of 1946, and they emigrated to Israel in 1948. And she lived a long life, and at the end of her life, near her death in 2008, she looked back and said that she lived a good life and that she felt fortunate and that she felt blessed. And that's such a powerful lesson about the ability of humans to overcome such extraordinary darkness. But I just can't help but feel that she also felt that she had lived a good life because she thought she had seen this kind of evil vanquished. And when I think about what we saw in Charlottesville last weekend, that we're seeing a rise of a neo-Nazi movement, the rise of white supremacists in America, and then most horrifically, a president who's not willing to be clear about it, I just feel this unbelievable sense of sorrow and confusion about where we've come to as a society. But I also think it's a really important opportunity for all of us to learn about the importance of doing the right thing. You know, one of the kind of funny luxuries of having a president who does the right thing in this moment is that it can sometimes make the rest of us feel as though we're absolved of our own responsibility to act in a certain way. But of course, each of us has a responsibility. Each of us needs to name evil for what it is. Each of us needs to identify the good in people. Each of us needs to work to lift that good up. Each of us needs to spread the basic values of love and inclusion and acceptance. And it's not good enough for a president or someone else to do it for us. Society thrives if we all do it together. And I just hope we can take this really, really grotesque moment as an opportunity to remember that that's what we have to do.
And I think that when you talk about when especially Holocaust survivors share their stories, there are understandably people who don't want to talk about it, who don't want to share their stories, or who wait until it, as you said, they're to a point when they're later in life, maybe where it's something that they can talk a little bit more about. For you, it sounds like you also feel like this is a moment that you think it's really important to share your family story.
Yeah, listen, I don't talk about it often, though it's an important part of who I am, because I don't want to...
You don't talk about it publicly.
I don't talk about it publicly because I don't want to... the last thing you want to do is to somehow cheapen it or use it for a political purpose. And thank God we live in a society where it's rarely directly relevant to the public discussions of the day. The tragic nightmare is that right now, in August of 2017, it's extremely directly relevant. And yes, I feel an absolute responsibility to share that story.
And when you say that, I was watching Vice News on Monday night, did a whole half hour devoted to Charlottesville, which was remarkable to me in that they basically were just telling the stories of the people who were there. And the reporter was with a lot of the neo-Nazis who were there. And almost every single person of the neo-Nazis who were interviewed said they felt like Sunday was a victory, and it was really important for them because they want everyone to know that this isn't just an internet movement, that this isn't just random people on the internet, that they're real people who, in the words of one of the gentlemen she interviewed, they want to start a cleansing to take back their homeland. And it, when you hear things like that, I wonder, it's just so hard to hear people say that in 2017, that people are actually saying that. And I wonder what kind of reaction you have to the fact that there are people who are very comfortable saying this publicly and marching and saying that they want...
They're not comfortable, Nyla. They're proud.
That's very true. Correct. Yeah.
You know, I want to come back to something else that my grandmother said to me. She said that when the Holocaust was starting and word was coming back to her about what was going on, her reaction was, that's not true. That isn't happening. And the reason it's not happening is it couldn't happen. I know that Germany is on some level the cradle of European society, and Germany is where Einstein comes from and where Beethoven comes from, and it just cannot be. And I just think we need to remember that we see these black and white pictures in history books and assume that what happened then was inevitable, and also assume that the fact that that doesn't happen now is just as inevitable. But no, it's not like that. These explosions of evil are shocking always when they happen. And so I think all of us need to understand that though it is unlikely that that would repeat itself tomorrow in America, it's not impossible. It's only impossible if we all choose to be vigilant.
So this resolution that you all passed on Sunday, the House has also, there bipartisan support in the House to adopt a similar resolution. Why was it important, you think, for the Illinois Senate to pass this resolution? Can you tell us a little bit more about what it said? Because I think sometimes people think, oh, it's just a resolution. Why does this matter?
It is just a resolution. But what it is an opportunity to state clearly what happened and how we feel about it. And I just think that here's what I think. The enemy here is hate, but the enemy is also lies, and the enemy is blurriness and muddiness. It is so unbelievably important to be clear and direct and specific about what happened and who did it and what's wrong and what's right.
And to name that and to say that they're Ku Klux Klan members,
correct,
that they're neo-Nazi members, and not just say this is an... For you, I wonder how you feel about the term alt-right, like what if you think...
I mean, I do think the term alt-right is a little sort of hip and sanitized. You know, I think we need to make sure we have a vocabulary that everybody understands, right? And what we know about Nazis is we know exactly what they did and where they stood. And what we know about white supremacists and the Ku Klux Klan is we know exactly where they stood and where they stand now. And those words mean specific things. And we need a vocabulary that's that specific. And we need to make sure that we don't allow any blurriness, any like what about the other side-ism, any, yeah, I mean, sure, they did a certain thing with their arm, but it doesn't really mean that they want to cleanse society of non-whites. We can't allow that blurriness. We need a kind of moral clarity. You know, this is an awkward topic around free speech, right? There's some people who say that the correct response to this is to forget about the First Amendment and shut down this kind of speech. And what I would say is that's not true. But the fact that the speech is allowed to happen places an extremely sacred responsibility on the rest of us to be very direct about what it is and what it means, and very direct about how we put a stop to it.
You mentioned your grandmother. You mentioned on the Senate floor, and you just mentioned this, about how it was important for her to talk about how good her life was, right? Because she ended up, you know, you, there's a sort of a whole line of, you know, she's your grandmother. Like, you have, there's, you know, you have kids, like, your family is continuing. How important is it, do you think, to talk about sort of, as you said, you mentioned this on the Senate floor and you mentioned your grandmother saying this, the good in life also?
It's so important. And I think this is an awkward thing to say, Nyla, but I think the bad too. I think we need to look inside of ourselves and know that that evil can find a home in anyone if we don't watch out for it and conduct ourselves in a certain way. And we also have to know that that good lies in everyone. And that's an every minute of every hour of every day project, to bring out the good, to know and understand and name and then relegate the evil. I worry a lot that we live in a society that thinks about people as good guys and bad guys. And
doesn't realize that that could be the same person.
That exists in everyone. And what we have to do is bring out the good in everyone and build a society that allows the good to rise to the top in everyone.
So when people say, I don't know what to do now, what should I do as an individual person? What would you say to them?
Well, one thing that I think is really important is to have difficult conversations. I think that we live in a society that is pretty dangerously segregated, and people speak more openly and freely in light groups than they do in diverse groups. And I think if you're in a group of people who look like you and live in your neighborhood and you hear them talking in a way that they may not themselves feel comfortable talking, if the room was more diverse, you got to say it then. You got to name it then. I think it's important for us to name our own privilege. I think it's important for us to look inside of our own life histories and know that we got to where we got in part because of luck, in part because of privilege, in part because of what we were born into. And I think it's really important to name that and to understand what that, the absence of that privilege, does to others. It's so easy in life to look at everything that has been given to you and actually think that you earned it. And that mistake, that conflation of what you've been given with what you've earned, is the beginning of the road to supremacy. We've got to squash it, and we've got to squash it loudly, and we've got to squash it even when that's difficult and awkward and uncomfortable, and it's happening at a barbecue on a Sunday afternoon when people don't want to have that conversation. That's when the conversation has to happen.
Daniel Biss is a senator. He's a state senator. He's a Democrat. He represents Illinois' 9th Senate District, Chicago's North Suburbs. Senator Biss, thanks for being with us. Thanks for sharing your family story with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for giving me this chance.
Again, we spoke with Senator Biss before President Trump's remarks yesterday. I should also note he's also one of 8 Democrats who are running for governor. We're asking you how you're responding to the events in Charlottesville, what conversations you're having. You can join us right now by calling 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to us at 21STShow, like Nancy just did in Springfield. Nancy says, tears from listening to the state senator. Yes, we have to stand up and stop this horror. Another tweet, this president should be removed. The GOP is complicit. Evil is alive. I'm sick at heart. How do you feel? Keep tweeting. You can give us a call as well. Our phone number again, 1-800-222-9455. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there are 11 groups in Illinois that are either neo-Nazi, Ku Klux Klan, or white nationalist groups. Growing up in Blue Island, just outside of Chicago, Christian Picciolini wasn't born into a Klan family, but he spent more than a decade, first as a teenager and then as a young man, being an active skinhead. Today, he's an activist who works to help people leave white supremacist organizations. He's the co-founder of Life After Hate, which is based in Chicago. And he's joining us again on the 21st. Christian, welcome back. Thanks for being here with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Nyla. I appreciate it.
Christian, can I first get your reaction to what the president said yesterday?
Gosh, you know, I think like most Americans went to sleep last night feeling sick to my stomach about the fact that, you know, while the president called out the KKK and white nationalists and neo-Nazis, he defended the alt-right. Now, somebody who comes from my past, having spent 8 years in the white power movement, I recognize what is happening right now. I recognize firsthand the tactics that are being used, the metastasis that's happened over the last 3 decades for this movement. And, you know, I'm here to very clearly say the alt-right are neo-Nazis. They are white supremacists. They are white nationalists. Let's just make that clear. What's happened over the last 30 years is this metastasizing of the movement where we've gone from, you know, what I used to be 30 years ago, a skinhead that was very clearly and visibly identified, to what we're seeing now with the alt-right, which is very clean cut, wearing the khakis and the polos. And this was a concerted strategy, Nyla. This was something that we started to plan 30 years ago because we recognized that the edginess of our movement back then was scaring away the average American white racist. And we told ourselves we have to change our tactics. We have to change our methods, and we need to blend in. So we started to grow our hair out. We started to cover our tattoos. We told people to go to college and recruit on campus. We told them to get jobs in law enforcement and go into the military to get training.
Christian, can I just stop you there? Yeah, we've got to take a break, unfortunately, but we'll continue this conversation in just a few minutes. You're listening to The 21st. We'll continue this conversation with Christian Piccolini as he's talking about what the alt-right movement means to him now. Thanks so much, Christian.
Support for The 21st comes from the School of Social Work at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing tomorrow's leaders to be advocates for and agents of social change. More information at socialwork.illinois.edu.
Listening to The 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the weekend's events in Charlottesville, President Trump's comments yesterday about it, with Christian Piccolini. He's with the Chicago-based group that he co-founded, Life After Hate. He's an activist who works to help people leave white supremacist organizations. Christian, just before the break, you were talking about what something you want to make clear to everybody who was once part of this movement that, I guess, would you say that's a sort of like a sanitizing of the image that's happening? So you were a skinhead. You were someone who people looked at and was scared of and knew right away. And you're saying that there was a concerted effort that was made, it has been made over the past decades to change that.
Yeah, you know, Nyla, I think what it is just a very smart marketing strategy on their part. Like I said earlier, we recognized back then that we were turning away people that we could have recruited. So the effort was to normalize, to blend in, to look like your neighbor, to look like the mechanic down the street or the doctor, a teacher, a lawyer. And they've successfully done that over the last 3 decades. I don't think that they would have as much prominence now if it weren't for the socio-political climate that we're all in at the moment. They feel very emboldened by the words of the president, by the actions and sometimes inactions of the president. That's evident in the support that he's seeing from David Duke and Richard Spencer and the rest. We're at a very critical stage right now where we can go one of two ways. And I can tell you this, that during the 8 years that I spent in the movement, I never felt that we were closer to a race war or a civil rights movement than we are right now. And I think we need to be very, very careful about how we approach this, especially because this is being, fed with rhetoric, fear rhetoric, and apologies from the top. So I think that Americans really need to use this as a turning point to come together, put aside whatever petty differences we may have, and figure out how to move forward as one country.
Christian, as you mentioned the president, I'd like to play a little bit, just a tiny portion of the what turned into a news conference yesterday at Trump Tower. Let's hear what he had to say.
I think there's blame on both sides. You look at both sides. I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it, and you don't have any doubt about it either. And if you reported it accurately, you would say.
How would I, as you said, the rhetoric of fear, you were saying that you believe the president is, you think that's, this is an example of that. I wonder how people who are in the movement, people who are neo-Nazis and white supremacists, how would they interpret what the president said there, that there's blame on both sides?
Well, I think he's bringing a moral equivalence to, you know, between the neo-Nazi extremists who were there demonstrating and the counter-protesters. And, you know, frankly, I saw two sides as well. I saw one side that, you know, participate in terrorist acts on a regular basis in our country. And then I saw proud Americans standing up for what they believe in as American ideals and what America can be. So the president is correct. There were two sides. But I would also say that if there were 500 ISIS members or ISIS-inspired supporters marching down the street, if you would have the same protection of both sides, if Americans were there protesting radical jihadists. And I don't quite think that he would have the same response to that. So to me, that tells me that there is an issue here with race, with color, that it's a class system that he's protecting a significant part of his base that is the alt-right. And without specifically calling them out, and in fact, you know, almost sticking up for them and making apologies for them, saying that they had a permit. Well, I don't think that they had a permit to commit murder. And as far as I'm concerned, the Constitution gave the protesters their permit to be able to go there and demonstrate against what is something that is very un-American.
I'm speaking with Christian Picciolini. He's the co-founder of Life After Hate. He's also the author of a book called Romantic Violence, Memoirs of an American Skinhead. We're talking to you as well. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to Mike in Central Illinois. Mike, you have a comment about the media. In fact, the president made a comment about the media. What are your thoughts on this, Mike?
Well, thank you for having me, by the way.
You're welcome.
First-time caller. But I just feel like right now, both sides of this, you got the left and the right, and I'm excluding all the stupid people that demonstrated down there in Carolinas, okay? And I mean both sides of that, because, again, like your guest just said, there are both sides to this. But the media is stirring up this fire by misreporting and misinforming and misguiding their message. I think it's very important.
In what way, Mike?
Well, for instance, we're now starting to
find. Do you think the media
is
overblowing this? Is that what you think is happening?
Well, I, you know, honestly, yeah. I think the media has an agenda. They're no longer reporting the news. They have an agenda to accomplish. They got to sell papers. They got to sell advertising dollars for TV. So the more extreme it can be, the more money they raise. It's perverted now. I don't watch the news anymore. I try to get my information off of public radio and listen to other people talk because I'll live through their experiences.
Mike, thanks for that comment. I appreciate you calling in. Let's go to Craig in Rockford. Craig, what's your perspective?
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to point out a historical perspective for the state of Illinois and the Midwest. In the 1920s, the largest membership in the Ku Klux Klan was in Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. It was very much like the Rotary Club at that time. Besides being against African Americans, it was anti-Catholic. It was very nativistic in origin and output. So we have to understand that this is not a new phenomenon. It's been in this culture for quite a long time. The other thing I wanted to point out is that the real effect of reducing these problems is to create greater collective coherence in our communities. And the ability to do that is based on having people eliminate the fatigue and stress in their lives through various techniques like meditation and have a greater clarity and perception so that the other is not seen as a threat to their own existence. many of these rights, many of these alt-right groups and these extreme neo-Nazi sympathizers are so filled with stress and tension, they cannot perceive the values, greater values, in their own lives or in the people around them. So we have to work
Craig,
at a very local level.
Craig, thank you also for that perspective. Christian, I wanted to ask you, Craig brought up two things. He talked about sort of the history of neo-Nazi KKK groups in Illinois. According to the Southern Poverty Law Center, there are 11 groups in Illinois that are either neo-Nazi KKK, white nationalist groups. I wanted to ask you about what the landscape looks like in Illinois for different hate groups and people who are part of this movement.
Well, you know, to be quite honest, it's moved away from the hate group model. You know, we've been applauding ourselves over the last couple of years that membership in hate groups has actually gone down. But I've warned against that because the strategy has always been to not join groups. So we had something 30 years ago called leaderless resistance, where we recognized that if we were part of groups, it was easier for law enforcement to infiltrate. It was easier for them to take down the infrastructure of the organization. So we encouraged people to go out there and act alone. We're calling that lone wolf these days. But let me just be clear, even though a person may act alone and they don't belong to a hate group, one, it's harder to measure. And two, it doesn't mean that they're not adherent to this ideology of hate. That is an umbrella across the alt-right, over the neo-Nazis, the KKK. They share fundamentally the same ideals. So I think we need to be very careful because when we typically think of white supremacists, we're thinking of neo-Nazis and KKK and what we're used to in this country. And it's changed. And it's changed because there is a strategic effort to really try and be invisible. And at one point, and they still do, the KKK calls themselves the Invisible Empire because under those hoods, they are your doctors, your lawyers, your judges, your priests, your teachers. But now we live in a climate where, you know, frankly, they feel very emboldened. They feel very supported, and they're not afraid to hide their identity anymore. Unfortunately, the pages of the comments on the internet are now spilling over into real life.
That said, Christian, two questions for you. We just got a call from Paul in Urbana. Remember last time we were on, we were talking about your funding for your group, Life After Hate. Originally, I know you had received funding under the Obama administration. The Trump administration shifted funding away from groups like yours who are trying to get people out of this to focus more on Muslim groups, radical Muslim groups. What is your funding situation right now for your organization?
So we were awarded a government grant under the Obama administration in January. We were called out specifically, the organization Life After Hate was called out specifically by Director of Homeland Security Jay Johnson as being a prime example of the future of the Countering Violent Extremism program, which was a community-led intervention or off-ramping strategy to try and help people who were becoming violent extremists perhaps find a different path. So we had applied and we'd won, and we were notified a week before President Obama left office that we were one of the one of the 33 awardees of this grant, and we were promised $400,000 to launch a new program to try and de-radicalize or find people one-on-one online to help them disengage. We were also going to use that money to help scale our interventionists and be able to train them because prior to the election, we were getting on average about two or three requests for help a week. Immediately after the election, we began to receive four or five requests a day.
And so when you say, just to be clear, when you say requests, these are people who are in people who want to no longer be white supremacists? Like, what does that mean?
So these are people who are in that movement and want to exit it, but don't know how. They don't know how to start over, or they're afraid of starting over, either for security reasons or because, it's hard to rebuild your identity and your community and your purpose. It's very daunting. But we also get requests from bystanders, from family members, from coworkers and friends who are very concerned about people in their lives that they see going down this path. And when I say intervention, I don't want people to think in the normal sense of intervention. We don't go to somebody's house and surprise them and then ship them off to treatment. When I work on this intervention strategy, what I'm doing is I listen more than I talk. And what I'm listening for are what I call potholes. What are the things that appeared in their path that caused them to deviate from their intended path? It could be trauma, it could be abuse, it could be addiction or mental illness, joblessness, whatever the case may be, or a perceived grievance that suddenly shifted their direction. I then start to fill in those potholes. I'm working on the human being rather than arguing with them ideologically, because I know that if I debate with them, I'm going to disagree with them, and both sides are going to get angry, and we're going to polarize. So what I do is I try to make the person a more resilient human being. I make them more self-confident. I give them the skills that they need. I will pair them up with job trainers and life coaches. And when they become more self-confident, it becomes less apparent to them that they have to blame the other, this invisible other person that is causing whatever problems exist in their lives. The way I challenge the narrative, however, is I will introduce them to people over time that challenges that narrative that they have. I may introduce a Holocaust denier to a Holocaust survivor. I may set up a dinner with an Islamophobe and a Muslim family, or somebody who is homophobic will spend a day in an LGBTQ center. And those immersion techniques are very effective because it allows these people who 9 times out of 10 have never, ever had a meaningful engagement with the people that they hate or a dialogue of any sort. Now it allows them to humanize these people in a very safe and controlled environment, a very compassionate and very empathetic environment. And it allows them to realize that we have more similarities than differences, and that the differences are enhancements that we need to embrace. What happens after that is we actually have an online private support network of over 100 formers, people who are just like me, who found their way out, have disengaged, gone on and done amazing things with their lives, and are now willing to help other people through a support network deal with the trauma that they've experienced, both of how they may have hurt others and how that hurt themselves.
We've been speaking with Christian Picciolini. He's been talking about Life After Hate, his group that he works with. I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation as well. Sunshine Clemens is co-founder of Black Lives Matter Springfield chapter. Sunshine, thanks for joining us on the 21st. I appreciate you being here with us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to play a clip for both of you that I'd love for you to respond to before the break. It's from Vice News Tonight on Monday, and they had a reporter who was with neo-Nazis all weekend in Charlottesville. This is their reporter, Elle Reeve, interviewing one of the speakers from the Unite the Right rally.
The amount of restraint that our people showed out there, I think, was astounding.
What do you think this means for the next alt-right protest?
I say it's going to be really tough to top, but we're up to the challenge.
Wait, why?
Why?
Tough to top. I mean, someone died.
I think that a lot more people are going to die before we're done here, frankly.
Why?
Why? Because people die every day. Right? I mean,
like of a heart attack, I mean violent death.
Well, people die violent deaths all the time, right? Like this is part of the reason that we want an ethno state, right?
From Vice News, Christian, we just have about a minute before the break. Sunshine, I also want to give you a chance to respond to. We may have to do that after the break. But Christian, do you think this is the beginning of more of these very public organized stance by white hate groups?
Absolutely. And in fact, these types of rallies have been going on for 30 years. And Nyla, I know you read my book. There's a whole chapter in my book that describes a rally just like the one that happened in Charlottesville. So this is something that we've been turning a blind eye to for so long, sweeping under the rug, thinking we live in a post-racial society, when in fact, the institutions and the systems that are in place are consistently fostering this white supremacy and oppression of others. And, you know, what that man said is the movement that I knew 30 years ago. It is exactly what is said behind closed doors when they're not talking to the media. And maybe this guy wasn't a great spokesperson, and maybe they're kicking themselves in the butt for letting him speak. But that was honest. That was exactly what these people believe. And that is their end goal, is to create a white homeland. And if that means destroying and killing everybody else in it that they feel doesn't belong, they will absolutely do that.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Sunshine Clemens. I want to thank Christian Picciolini for joining us as well. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about this weekend's events in Charlottesville, how Illinois is reacting to this. We're asking you your thoughts on this, what conversations you've been having that you want to share with us. You can tweet to us. Continue to keep the tweets coming at 21STShow. That's our handle, 21st Show. You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. We've got on the line with me right now, Sunshine Clemens is the co-founder of the Springfield chapter of Black Lives Matter. Sunshine, we were just hearing an interview with someone who was at one of the speakers from the, quote, Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, talking about how he wants to create an ethno-state. I just wonder for you if you feel like as someone, just wonder your reaction, first of all, to all of this, to that comment, to what you were first thinking when you saw the events unfold in Charlottesville this past weekend.
My initial reaction, honestly, was, it's devastating to see, but it's really not that surprising. I know some people are just completely shocked by what's going on, but this is something that's been happening. Like Christian said before the break, this is something that's been going on for a very long time. And we now have a commander-in-chief who does not put forth the effort to make it clear that these things are not acceptable. So they obviously feel emboldened by, you know, having someone who, you know, bats for their team in their mind at a public stage who's saying that these things are basically not going to be punished. They're not going to be targeted. They're scaling back things on a national level, protections that, you know, we've had in the past. So you could kind of see this coming, even though people, you know, did not want to believe that. So my initial reaction was hurt, but unfortunately was not shock.
Right.
And I do believe that, you know, we'll see a lot more of these events because the comments that were made at these press conferences, there wasn't a clear finger pointed at, this is not acceptable. When a finger was pointed, it was pointed at both sides saying basically that everyone's done something wrong. And he made sure to point out that, you know, the people with the tiki torches, they were, you know, they had their permit. They were peacefully, doing what they wanted to do and, you know, about taking the statue down. So he made it sound like they were in the right to begin with. So that obviously, you know, in their mind, I think would feed the fact that, you know, this is what we're doing is the right thing to do when the president is on our side.
Sunshine, and even in this past hour, I think we've heard a variety of reactions from people listening to the show. We had a caller, Mike, who said that he blames this on the media. We just had a tweet, actually, in response to that caller saying Mike should watch the actual footage and words from the weekend. Media causing this is not the clear thinking. I guess I would ask you what you would say to people who seem shocked by what took place last weekend.
For people who are shocked, I honestly believe that they are not quite as in tune and maybe just get their resources from a limited selection of places. If you, want that information, there's plenty of information out there, but I know sometimes it's easy to turn a blind eye to things that, you know, are not as they should be because you don't want to focus on, you know, on the negative. So, but at this point, when the negative reaches this scale, you really cannot avoid it. So it's being put in people's faces, regardless of whether they want to see it or not. But if it's not something like this, where it's just, you know, nationally broadcast on every channel, it's easy to turn away from that. So I think people that believe that, you know, we've maybe come further than we really have in race issues in this country and race relations, I think they've, in some ways, it's easy to kind of avoid things that you don't want to see. So I think that's just, you know, what many people do. You don't want to focus on, you know, on what's wrong.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess I would say, what would you, what are, do you, I wonder, does it sadden you that it takes this level of tragedy for people to begin speaking up and saying this is a problem?
It does, because, and it also saddens me that there's so much support for people that spew so much hate. I mean, they have just ridiculous numbers of people that, you know, that feel this way, you know, the all right, the neo-Nazi, whatever they want to describe themselves as, they're a hate group, because that is what they do. They hate. If you're not like them, if you're not, don't have the same agenda as them, you come here from another country, you have another skin tone, they are superior to you in their mind. So they are a hate group, and I find it unfortunate that so many people refuse to, you know, believe that it's a problem in this country unless something like Charlottesville happens. But unfortunately, I think a lot more people are going to have their eyes open, because I see several more Charlottesvilles coming in the future.
That said, I wonder where you go from here as someone who co-founded the Springfield Matter of Black Lives Matter.
We're just trying to continue to put forth the information that we've been doing in the past, trying to connect with people, provide information, be a place where people can come and get answers. We're open to talking to people, even people that don't understand what Black Lives Matter is, don't like the organization, think that, you know, for some reason we are saying that our lives matter more than other nationalities. We're willing to work with and talk with anyone, because you cannot change or help someone see the error of, you know, their thought process if you're not willing to sit down and have those hard conversations with them.
Thanks for joining us, Sunshine. We'll be tweeting out information about your group if you'd like to connect with her. Sunshine Clemens is the co-founder of the Springfield chapter of Black Lives Matter. Sunshine, I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Corn dogs, fried Twinkies, and food on a stick. That's normally what people pick up at the state fair. But on Saturday, anyone who's at the Illinois State Fair has a chance to buy items like rare souvenir medallions from the Chicago's World Fair, a signed 1983 Ryan Sandberg baseball card, or thousands of other items. It's part of more than $100,000 worth of unclaimed property that's being put up for live auction by the Illinois Treasurer's Office. Democratic State Treasurer Michael Frerix is on the line with us right now. Treasurer, welcome back to the 21st.
Nyla, thank you for having me. Excited to talk about the State Fair.
The State Fair. This is a little bit different than what we normally talk about. This is an impressive list of items. Can you tell us what's going to be up for sale in this auction?
Well, we've got something for every collector out there. We're excited to bring this unclaimed property auction back to the State Fair. Judy Bart Topinka used to do this. She loved the State Fair. She loved doing this, driving people to the fairgrounds. And when I came into office, a lot of people asked me, would you bring this back? That's what we're doing. And so this Saturday, next Saturday, August 19th, at the Illinois State Fairgrounds on a Lincoln stage, they're going to have an opportunity to bid on things like baseball cards, those medallions you talked about, jewelry, collector coins collected from a 1622 shipwreck. There's something for everyone.
So, for example, this signed 1983 Ryan Sandberg baseball card, how much do you think that's going to go for?
Not enough. As a lifelong Cubs fan, okay. As someone growing up in Gifford, Illinois, we didn't have cable TV when I was a young kid. We got it, I think, in 1984, which brought WGN to my household, which meant in that summer I could watch just about every Chicago Cubs baseball game. It was the year Ryan Sandberg won the MVP. The Cubs won the National League East back before we had a Central Division, and I would love to bid on it. Unfortunately, I am prohibited from bidding on anything in our auctions. So So we've had it appraised. We think there's going to be a lot of interest. We've had people coming to our auction previews, and I think we're going to have a good crowd, but would encourage more people to just come out and look. We have over thousands of items valued at over $113,000.
Okay, remind us where all of this comes from, because the state of Illinois is actually holding, is it more than $2 billion in quote-unquote lost property and money?
That's correct. Most of it is in the form of money. It could be a last paycheck you did in cash. It could be a refund from a deposit you had with the electric company or the water company. It could be the proceeds from a life insurance policy that you didn't know you're the beneficiary of. So we have over $2 billion, and it's my goal to get it back into people's hands. We know it does a lot more good when that money is circulating through the community than it does sitting in a bank account in Springfield. Now, that's where a lot of the money comes in, but people also store valuables in safe deposit boxes. And occasionally, they either forget about them or someone passes away without telling their loved ones about the safe deposit box. And in those cases, if the bank can't find the rightful owner or the heir for 5 years, they turn the property over to us. We try for another 5 years to track down the rightful owners. But if after 10 years they don't come forward to claim their property, we run out of space in our vault and we have to auction these items off. But we don't get to keep the proceeds. We hold on to the proceeds. We serve as a fiduciary for the property owner. So if 10 years, 20 years, 50 years from now, they or the heirs show up, they will get the value that the property sold for at auction.
So this money does not go to, say, pay off state debt, which I think everybody thinks, oh, this will be great. We'll help the state out.
It is nice if you want to show up because there's something you want to buy, then that is good for you. If you are showing up to help out with the state debt, then I'm sorry that this money still will belong to the original owner.
And how do people go about claiming that?
Well, so they can go to illinoistreasurer.gov. There's a very simple form on there. You can put in your first name, last name, address. You don't even have to fill in all of the blanks, and we'll run a search for you to see if that name, if we have anyone in our database. Now, like I said, there are over $2 billion in property. There are thousands of people in our system. And we find that about one in four people who go and check find we have something that belongs to them. And the average amount is about $1,000. So it's really worth your time and effort. If you've checked before and didn't find anything, we bring in property all the time. At least a couple of times a year, we bring in big batches. And so every 6 months or so, you should check and see if we have something that might belong to you.
And are there things that you find in the safe deposit boxes that you won't sell?
Yeah, I guess there are some things, some really personal items we won't sell. We don't sell military medals. We've been working very hard to return those. We won't auction off someone's valor. In the last 6 or 7 months, we returned 3 Purple Hearts, either to the recipient or to their loved ones. And that really is a special ceremony when you can return military medals to a family member.
Yeah.
It's really nice.
Sure that's really meaningful for folks. Okay, so the auction is on Saturday. We're going to tweet out all the details for that, as well as how you can look up your unclaimed property. We'll have that on our website also if you didn't catch what the treasurer said. I can't let you go without asking you. We've been having a very fun conversation about the state fair, but you're serious. We are obviously still in a pretty serious situation with our state's finances, even though we do have a budget. I have to ask you about credit rating agencies saying that Illinois still could face a downgrade because of where we're at with our pension shortfalls and our billions of dollars in unpaid bills. It's your job to make smart investment choices with our money. Just have to ask what you're thinking about credit rating agencies and how the Treasurer's Office is positioning itself now.
Well, so we have passed a budget, but I caution people, it's not a full budget. It's currently in the midst of a self-destruct right now. In order for funds for K-12 schools to be released, there has to be a new education funding formula. The General Assembly passed a bill that the governor has vetoed. So right now, there's no new formula in place. The comptroller cannot release money for schools, and I know that some rating agencies have said this is a problem and could result in a downgrade. But even when we passed the budget, it looked like there would be funding for schools in place. Moody's Investment Services said they didn't do anything to really address the backlog of bills or the unfunded liability in our pension system. And those are very big concerns for them out there for the future health and viability of the state and our ability to repay on bonds. So they've said that that we weren't suffering an immediate downgrade to junk, but that it could be in the future, and they're going to continue to watch and review. And that is just would be terrible for the state of Illinois. No state has ever received junk bond status yet. It would make it very difficult to borrow money. And if we did, we'd be paying significantly more in interest. We'd be sending money to Wall Street bondholders rather than investing it in our roads and our bridges and our schools. And so it really is imperative for people to stop campaigning, to stop pointing fingers, and to sit down and get something worked out.
That's our Democratic State Treasurer, Michael Frericks, with us talking about obviously the serious situation we're in, the state finances, also being able to let us know a little bit about this auction that's coming up this Saturday at the Illinois State Fair. Treasurer, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Nyla, thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
And that does it for us today. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. We're a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks to everyone who called and tweeted as well. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a good day.